No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony, along with my brand new exciting co-host, Maria Sanchez. Our show hopes to start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. We have no guests tonight, but we're excited that we have a new co-host who I'll introduce to you in a moment, Maria Sanchez. So call in, guys. Don't let poor Maria have to deal with me for a whole hour without any other interaction. Call in and say hello and welcome her to the show, if nothing else. Again, that number is 888-627-6008. First, let me give you an update on what's going on in statehood in the District of Columbia. Not much in the last 2 weeks. There really hasn't been a whole lot. So what's going on right now is we still have 125 co-sponsors in the House of our statehood bill and 18 co-sponsors in the United States Senate. So that's all that's going on right now. We're quickly approaching Veterans Day, as you know, in a couple of weeks, and we'll be doing some statehood activities about around that, and we'll report back to you on that. We're going to start, the show's taking a turn. We're going to start a new era of Shadow Politics starting tonight with our new co-host, Maria Sanchez. Before I introduce Maria, though, I want to talk for a second about my former co-host and the woman that started the show with me, Kathleen Gomez. Kathleen was on the show for 2.5 years and had to leave suddenly because she took a job as a corporate lobbyist, and corporations want you representing their interests and only their interests, which I understand. And very often you have to sign exclusive agreements with them so that you don't represent anybody else. And so that's what Kathleen had to do, and she had to leave the show abruptly because she started her job right away, which is great. We wish her all the luck in the world. But I want to tell you, when I started this show, I decided to contact my old friend Kathleen because I thought it would be boring for everybody to just listen to me. And Kathleen was with the show for 2.5 years. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of 130 shows. I think she may have missed one, if she missed any. I don't remember if she missed any at all, but it was a heck of a commitment. And she showed up every week, and she showed up prepared, and she really added significantly to what the show was and is. And I can't thank her enough for that. She's one of my dearest friends, and we all wish her the best of luck. And anybody that wants to get a hold of Kathleen or Skype her or give her good wishes can send them to the show at BBS, and we'll make sure she gets them. Again, Kathleen, thank you. I hope you're out there listening somewhere. Maybe she'll call in from time to time. And we really appreciate everything she's done to make this show a great show. And in that regard, I had to replace her because she left, and I knew that you would be bored just listening to me. And that was a hard choice, but It was hard to find somebody that I thought could replace Kathleen. So we're moving in a little different direction. We had a guest on our show over a year ago named Maria Sanchez. This is a really bright woman, personable, and she's everything that's different than what I am. I'm a Democrat. She's a Republican. I live on the East Coast. She lives on the West Coast. She's a mom. I'm a dad. So the hope is that we'll be able to mix it up a little bit because, you know, we come from different perspectives. And she, let me tell you something. This is a brilliant woman. I'm so excited that she's accepted my invitation to be on the show. I just hope I can keep her on the show without driving her crazy. And I think it'll be a whole new era for us because we'll start seeing things from different perspective. Kathleen, although she will argue this point with me, is really a Democrat and has always been a Democrat, and we see things very much alike. My hope is that Maria and I have different perspectives because that's what this show's about. It was about bringing people together, and there's such a problem in Washington doing that. So without further delay, let me introduce Maria Sanchez, who is too accomplished for me to just give you her resume quickly. So we'll let her explain all the wonderful things she's done. And thanks so much for being with us, Maria, and welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you as a partner in this endeavor.
Well, Senator Brown, first of all, thank you. And it was with all due humility that I am here with you today and every Sunday moving forward. I want you to know how grateful I am that you have given me this opportunity to engage with you. And I have a feeling, even though our orientations are different politically with whatever letter we put behind our name and the East Coast, West Coast thing, we're probably going to agree on more things than you might realize. And that was one of the things that you and Kathleen said when I was a guest on your program, that you expected more of the knee-jerk, right-wing, Christian kind of philosophy, and that's not who I am. So I would describe myself as fiscally conservative, but socially very liberal. And that's what we probably are going to have a lot of agreement on in terms of policies or, you know, disenfranchised or the isms that are out there in terms of sexism and racism and all of those sorts of things. So I can't tell you how thrilled I am. Talk radio, I believe, is one of the most unique opportunities for folks to find what they're looking for without a dress rehearsal, without a second take. What you see is what you get. It's live. There's no safety net. And because of that, it's pretty, you know, you don't know where it's going to go, depending on what you have to say, what I have to say, what a caller might have to say. So that's what makes, I think, talk radio so exciting and still relevant to this day.
Well, and I agree with you, and that's what I find exciting about it. And the thing that I find, you know, most interesting and exciting about having you on the show is that you have so much experience at it. I started doing this because I wanted to talk about some of the problems we had here in Washington, and I wanted to bring people together, but I had no experience at it. So it's been a steep learning curve for me. I know that you just have an incredible amount of experience at it, and I find that so interesting, and I think it will move the show in new directions. And so I'm very hopeful that the new Shadow Politics, maybe we should think of a new name, you know, Shadow Politics with Maria and Mike or something. But I think that I'm very hopeful that we'll move in a positive direction, which we're not doing in Washington. You know, we're in such gridlock. And I think that you and I are both old enough to, although you're eons younger than I am, I know that we're both old enough to remember a time when, you know, Republicans and Democrats got along better. There were many Republicans like Barry Goldwater and I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, Lowell Weicker and there was one, Millicent Fenwick from New Jersey, Bob Dole, many people that I respected in the Republican Party. And I think that they had the same feeling about certain Democrats. So we're going to try to get that back in America. But before we go there and save the world, tell us a little bit about yourself and let our listeners know who you are. They've listened to me prattle on for 2.5 years, so they have some idea who I am. But tell them about your experience.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate the opportunity. It's not something that I do very easily. But I have been an activist my whole life and within the conventional realms, like, so not defying the laws or what have you. But I believe that every one of us is responsible for what goes on in Washington and in our capitals. And if you don't do something, you don't have a right to complain. So yeah. I think that's it. And it starts with voting. And then we go for, you know, however else you want to help in terms of your city councils or your state governments or your D.C. elected officials. But if you don't vote, you can't, you don't have any skin in the game. So I'm a real believer about grassroots and, you know, mean what you say and say what you mean in that regard. And then just as far as the party goes, my folks are immigrants. They speak English as their second language. My dad's first generation. And they were kind of like, and they were entrepreneurs. So they were like, if we can do it, people can do it. So we all agree that there comes sometimes in folks' lives where they do need a handout. They do need some help. They do need some assistance. But it shouldn't be chronic. So that's the whole, you know, teach them to fish rather than give them the fish kind of philosophy. And so because I was raised with that mentality, I naturally tended to lean towards the Republican Party that at the time especially was about empowering people to make and take care of themselves and their families. So that's really why I started in that regard. And I do have to share with you, Senator, I'm not proud of some of the things that the people in the party have done and are doing, especially the far right and the Tea Party. I'm not a fan of them. And I think that they're more divisive and polarizing than anything, and that is really troubling to me.
Well, me too. But, you know, one thing that I think that I see maybe a lot of people don't see, I think we want to see what we all want to see, what we want to see, what we expect to see. And I've been in politics long enough to understand that the quality of people, there's a different agenda in the Republican and Democratic parties, but the quality of people that are involved in both parties is pretty much the same. You know, whenever I get mad at the Republicans, I think of the fact that my brother, who in my opinion is the most brilliant and wonderful person I know, is a Republican. And I say to myself, you know, there are good people in the Republican Party and you know, people that I respect and honor. And I also take responsibility for things that Democrats, do. For example, I love the fact that when we talk about civil rights, which we do all the time here in Washington, in our particular struggle, that a lot of young people talk about how the Republican Party discriminates. And I have to remind them that it was Democrats that stood in the schoolhouse doors in the South, and it was Democrats that discriminated against people during the civil rights movement. And the one thing I tell young people, which always amazes them, is that Martin Luther King Jr. was a Republican. They really have a hard time with that, it's true. He was a Republican, and most African Americans were Republicans for exactly the reason that Condoleezza Rice, when she served the Republican Party, said she was a Republican. She was a Republican because the Democrats wouldn't let her father vote. And that was the truth in the South in the 1940s and 50s. So we all have our skeletons in the closet. You know, we used to say when the votes would come in from Chicago, we would say, does that include the dead vote? Because we all accepted that we cheated in the 1960 election and counted people that weren't were no longer with us. So neither one of us, neither group has the right to, I think, take a tone with the other that we're beyond reproach, or to be, in fact, the least bit sanctimonious. I remember all the mayors of North New Jersey, where I grew up, they were all thrown in jail, and most of them were Democrats. So I accept that too.
It probably boils down that we're human, right? So the human experience is that we make mistakes, and we're not always pure with our intentions, and not everybody lives with integrity. And then you take it where power comes into play, and ego, and money. And so that doesn't have an R or a D behind it. That's the human experience. That's universal. So I appreciate what you said about that, because I don't certainly suggest that just because somebody's a Republican that they should be respected or they deserve anything. They have to prove it. You don't just get it, you know. And I think maybe that's what part of the problem is, I believe, in Washington, is that we don't allow people to be human. So we don't often elect folks who have made some mistakes, who may have stumbled in their personal lives or financially or had an error in judgment, because we expect our leaders to be perfect, and they're not, unless they have a good PR team that covers up and all that sort of stuff. And then when we find out they made mistakes, so we're always disillusioned and disappointed, just like our athletes and the entertainers. We expect them to be bigger than life and perfect, and they're not. They're human.
Yeah, and we certainly, power does corrupt. And I've seen a lot of people that went into politics to make a better world, because I don't think a lot of people get into it for the money. But then when you get to power, it really is. I don't know what you want to call it, an aphrodisiac or a drug or whatever. It really does work that way. Because when you think about money, the only thing that money can really do for you, once you've made subsistence, once you have a house, a roof over your head, and food in your stomach, really the only thing that money can do for you is give you more power over your life. You can have a bigger place to live or a nicer car or college for your kids or whatever your priorities are. But and when you get the power in government, it's like mainlining this stuff. You don't even need the money anymore. You've got the power. And very often that corrupts people. They forget. Here in Washington, D.C., locally, we're a prime example of that. We've had three councilmen go to jail. We've got our former mayor has been under investigation for 4 years. Six people in his campaign, six out of like 12 campaign staffers, have pleaded guilty to malfeasance of one form or another. One of my favorites was a few weeks ago, a woman pleaded guilty to accepting unemployment insurance compensation while she was working on the mayor's campaign. And then when he got elected, they made her director of the Department of Employment Services, the people that she had been stealing money from. And everybody says, well, do you think he really knew that they were stealing money? Well, you know what? That's not the point. You earlier, Maria, when you said that you were honored to have the opportunity to be on the show and speak and give your opinion, I got to tell you, that's the way I feel about serving in government. I feel like it's an honor. I feel like people have trusted me and given me, and said, we want you to represent us. And every time you don't represent them properly, you make mistakes, of course. But when you do stuff in your own self-interest, it really is an abdication of that trust that they put in you. And I'm not sure why more people don't feel that way, but
I think that's brilliant what you just said. You really encapsulated that lovely, because it should be an honor and a privilege, because folks have chosen you by their vote, by their privilege that they have to vote, to trust you to do what's in their best interest. There's trust there. Yep. And that, I think, would be a very heavy experience, thinking that all these people trust you and using that trust wisely and judiciously and with integrity. And it's a shame that more folks don't feel it. Right, exactly.
Right.
I mean, that's so beautiful, Michael. I don't know how you survived so long.
Well, because you know what?
You've got altruism in your blood.
Just to be honest with you, my path in politics is easy because I have one issue, really, and that's making people equal. So I don't come under a lot of attack. You know, nobody tries to bribe me, so it's easy for me to be honest. You know, some of those things. But since Maria is reluctant to tell you how wonderful she is, I'm obviously going to have to step in here and tell you a few things that she's done. She's on the board of directors of a couple of public, couple of local groups that help people in her area. And I hope you'll tell us a little bit about that. I know that you've been on the board of directors of the Girl Scouts. I want you to know that my daughter and I, we live on a traffic circle in Washington, D.C., which is kind of a strange thing. We have these circles like they have in Paris. And once after schlepping Girl Scout cookies all over the neighborhood and selling about 20 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in an 8-hour shift, we put up a sign on the traffic circle and we sold 400 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in about an hour and a half. So after that, we started selling them on the circle, kind of a drive-through. It was kind of a drive-through thing. People would pull up at the bus stop, and we'd hand them the cookies through the window. And we just, just setting the world on fire with Girl Scout cookies. And that doesn't even include the dozen or so boxes that I ate while we were selling, because I'm a big fan of Girl Scout cookies. So you've worked with the Girl Scouts and you've worked with community groups. I know you've worked and helped start a group that deals with teenage runaways. Another thing that I've been involved with here in D.C. These are all the reasons that I asked you to be on the show, because I not only think that you're intelligent and articulate, but your heart's in the right place. You really helped in your community. And that's another thing we have to realize. You know, as liberals, I think we think we're out there trying to save the world and the Republicans really don't care about it. And that's just not true. In my public service work, when I've worked in the community, I've met as many wonderful Republicans as I have Democrats.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, because I think that philanthropy and volunteerism is really how we do make the world a better place on an organic level. And that's why I always say, even if you have an hour a month to give of yourself, your time, your treasure, your talent, it makes a difference. It all adds up. And I was raised, my folks always volunteered. My mom was president of the United Way, and my dad was the president of this. And so to me, he was in Kiwanis, and I'm in Rotary. And, you know, philanthropy is you do what you can. It doesn't mean writing the check necessarily. It can be about selling Girl Scout cookies, which, by the way, thank you for that. You have no idea how that story warms my heart, because raising girls with courage, confidence, and character is one of their mottos. And part of the cookie sales is to teach them about commerce, about business. This box costs us this much. We sell it for this much. We make a profit for that much. The troop gets this much. It allows us to do that. And what better way to learn it than selling cookies?
Yeah.
And you're benefiting the organization.
When my older sister was in high school, she belonged to a thing called Junior Achievement. Now, I don't know where Junior Achievement has gone, but Junior Achievement used to do the same thing, but they would make things. You know, they would. I remember they sent a. There was a time when they had a bunch of empty jars that they would pour some sort of wax in, and they would make candles and sell the candles in the neighborhood, and they would do every other thing. And that was the whole idea behind Junior Achievement, was to make people that were business savvy. And, you know, we're talking about the 1950s when girls really weren't trained in that sort of thing. You know, she took this business stuff in high school, but she also took home economics. You know, that was in the days when we taught girls home economics. And my sister became one heck of a business person. She really did. And I'm sure that things like Junior Achievement helped. Now I know you have four children. Tell us about your children.
My children are all on their own, so mommy uh-huh. is home alone, uh-huh. and they are, as of yesterday, they're 24, 26, 28, and 29, so it was fast and furious. Two have graduated from college, and two are stutter-stepping their way through college, so my third son is getting his Bachelor's of Arts in Music, but he's got 35 piano clients. So it's taking up all his time to make a living at what he does as a passion. So he keeps arguing, Mom, why do I need the degree? And I'm like, you're like three classes away. Just do it and get it done. So, but then I've learned, and I'm old enough to know, that we have to love our children unconditionally and accept them for who they are, not who we want them to be necessarily. And so this is his journey, and I do have every confidence that he will take those last three classes and get the piece of paper, but I think he gets a little joy in kind of teasing me about it. Wow. And then the irony is that I'm getting my master's degree in clinical psychology, so I'm practicing what I'm preaching to them, at least. They know it's not just words, but I'm doing something, too, for myself and for another career. I want to be a clinical therapist. And so they see me with the books, and they see me with the classes and the projects and the presentations and the midterms and the finals and all the reading that is required at the graduate level. It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. I've been there and done that. And I feel this pain, too, with music. I have several friends that are musicians, you know, that grew up in the 1960s, and they were all going to be rock stars. And some of them have degrees in music, have bachelor's degrees in music, and have not pursued music. They pursue music as a hobby. But music's a tough field. Art's a tough field. You know, I know some very, very talented people who, you know, have stutter-stepped their way through life now that we're all in our 60s, me and my friends. But I have friends that are in their 60s that have been playing together since they were in middle school. Been playing in a band together. Yeah, and they still play together. They don't get together as much as they used to, but they still play together. And they've been playing so long together, they don't even need to practice. They just show up somewhere and it's like old home week. That's a tough that's a tough way to go.
And living in Los Angeles, we're surrounded by the entertainment world. I actually was an executive producer on a sitcom for NBC, I don't know, about 15 years ago or so, and hiring the writers and then doing the casting and then getting the director and all of that goes into it. I would look like we had a very juicy part for a woman of substance, so it was about a 40-something-year-old woman role. We got some, you would know their name, amazing women coming to audition for this position because you don't always get in the sitcom world somebody that is somewhat inspirational, that's strong, et cetera, that's female. And these gals were perspiring and their lips were trembling and they're in their 40s. They've been doing this for how long? And I was like, who would want that pressure on a regular basis? Right. No, thank you. It was it was really a learning experience for me. And I guess they thrive on that on some level, the adrenaline. And if you do hit it, you're talking phone numbers for paychecks. And, you might not have to work ever again if your series is a hit. And I guess that's what keeps people going, too.
Yeah, and I think a passion for it. I certainly see it with my musician friends who work other jobs because after they hit 30 years old and realize that they weren't going to be the next Beatles or Rolling Stones or whatever the group might be, that they took real jobs in life and they work 9 to 5 and then go out at night. And play, till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning because they love it so much. And, I don't know how they do it either. I really don't.
Which is, it really speaks to their passion, which is lovely because that means that they do it because they love it, not because it's lucrative or they're getting famous or anything. mean, that's admirable.
That's absolutely true. I and, you know, that. I was a great stutter stepper. I was, I lost both my parents when I was 15 years old. And my sister, my older sister, who ended up raising me from that point, was working full time and going to law school full time. I never even saw her usually. And my brother just retired as president of a college. So, you know, they were absolutely thrilled with me when I came home at 16 and said, you know what, I'm dropping out of high school because if you haven't learned it by the time you're 16, you don't need to know it. And that's what a know-it-all I was. And I dropped out and finally went back, and because my sister was brilliant and figured out a way to entice me to go back to get into college, I got an equivalency diploma, went to college, did the community college, then went to the state university, then got in a graduate program and got a master's degree at a good state university. And so, you know, I was not a traditional student, and I'm married to a woman who was the valedictorian of her high school. The day she graduated, I'm absolutely positive she knew exactly where she was going to spend the next 4 years, got her a degree at the top of her class, you know, at the, you know, at 21. And then, you know, after we got married, decided she wanted to go back to school, got a master's degree, straight A's, and is now a librarian. So we both went in diverse paths, and our children have, you know, they pretty much gone right on to college, but they attacked it at different, you know, at different speeds. And you're right. You have to be supportive and you have to love them and you have to understand that it's their journey and, you know, that you're just along for the ride and to be supportive. Oh, and as a dad with two daughters, to pay all the bills that should happen to crop up until they until they reach an age of maturity. You know, it's funny, our 22-year-old now is paying her own rent and paying her, you know. And I want to tell you one of the funniest things is that I went to the beach last week with a couple of friends. They have a beach house in Myrtle Beach, and their daughter, who is a teacher, just graduated from college, is a teacher down there, lives in the house, and when we came down for you know, a week or 3 or 4 days, she went and you know, stayed at a friend's house. But she came through the house one day when we were there, and she complained because all the lights were on. And all I could think is how many millions of times I've said that to my kids. If you're not going to be in the bathroom, shut out the light, you know, or scream global warming or something. But it was funny to see now that she's paying the electric bill, she's yelling at her mom for leaving the light on in the bathroom. So,
that
you
is
know,
hilarious.
Things do
it's,
come.
Yeah, role reversal, right?
Do come
it's
full
really
circle.
Funny. Yeah, if we're old enough, I got my musician son, the third one that we've been referencing, he sent me a text a week ago. I was in class, so I didn't get it till I got home because I'm doing my very best not to text and drive or read and drive, trying to make that commitment. And so I pull into the garage, and basically he said, I know this is going to sound really random, but I just wanted you to know that as I've gotten older and watched life unfold, I cannot believe how you were always there for me. You made my high times better and my disappointing times not so bad. And he went on and on about what you're the best mother that I could ever have asked for. This is a 26-year-old, right? Of course, I burst into tears. But it was like, wow. Because I was a single mom. The kids were 2, 4, 6, and 8 when their dad and I divorced. So, and I had them 90% of the time. And that's all they've ever known. You know, they don't know a two-parent household and that sort of luxury that you've been able to afford your children, which I am envious of. But I guess they were paying attention.
First of all, let me tell you something. My wife would tell you that she was a single mom. My children used to say, my oldest daughter would say, Mommy's got 4 kids. She got the 3 of us and you, Dad. So,
really?
You know, my genius is that that. Yeah, my wife's has been a great mom, and you know, I'm teasing, of course, but she really has done a great job with all three of my kids, and you know, being a dad, it's just such. I guess as your kids get older, they start to realize, because they just accept when they're younger that this is your responsibility. You know,
right.
Whatever their whim is your responsibility. But then when they get older and they start to look back, I think they realize how much you've really done and how much you've really sacrificed. And for me, a dad is such an easier job. You know, dad's like being vice president. It's really, you know what I mean? You step in if something happens to the president, if she's tied up that day and they need stuff. And even when my kids got older, they used to call me on the phone. They'd go, Dad, is mommy there? And I'd say to them, what do you want? And they'd say, we want mommy. Like, what don't you understand? You know, we want to speak to the person who's in charge. We really don't want to deal with you unless there's money involved. If they want to talk to you directly, it's a financial decision. So you're like a cross between the vice president and the treasurer of the country. You know, you get to sign the checks for them. But yeah, being moms is such a tough thing. And you know, that was my mom. My mom was a single mom, and she worked so hard for all of us. And you know, you have the greatest respect for that. And I've spent my life, I was raised by women, and I've spent my life with more women in my life than men. And some people have, when I was younger, would find that unusual, but women make great friends. They make great, you know what I mean? They're, and I don't know if it's because of their general nurturing, you know, tendency to nurture or what, but they make great friends. You can always depend on them. You know, this has been my experience. I have a lot of great friends like Kathleen, who stepped up and did our show. So we're going to take a little break right now, and then Marie and I are going to come back and talk about some substantial issues, and we'll get that rolling in a minute. But let's take a little break, and we're going to play a song. And this goes out to Kathleen Gomez, wherever you are. Thanks for all your help, and we hope to talk to you soon. We'll be back in a minute. Here's one from Elton John.
I hope the day will be a light, a highway for friends I found on every road. Can you ever think of any better way for the lost and weary travelers to go?
Okay, and we're back. We're back. We've said goodbye, Kathleen. We'll see you soon. And we're back. We hope some of you guys will call in. I don't see any callers out there right now. So Maria and I are going to move on. And since this is Maria's first night on the show, I'm going to let you. What do you want to talk about, Maria?
Well, part of me thinks that their conversation prior to the Elton John song about our mothers and our daughters and our wives, if you will, is that the lack of opportunity for women in general politically, Hillary Clinton case exception, and how, you know, we are 50%, if not a little bit more, of the population, more of the college graduates, more of the graduate school graduates. And even in this day and age, we can't seem to get parity in that regard. I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
Well, you know, I'm not either. And when I was in graduate school, because it was the really the cutting edge thing, and I had been raised by women who made less money, I studied the whole thing and actually did my master's thesis on occupational segregation, which was a big problem for women. You know, back in the 1970s, women, there were something like 158 bona fide occupations that were classified by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and 75% of women were found in five of them. They were found in teaching, nursing, clerical work, waitressing, and I forget what the other one was, maybe child care. Yeah, and so because it was an oversupply of women in all these areas, like teaching is a great example, they were paid less. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of the law of supply and demand works in labor markets the way it works in other markets. And when you have an oversupply of labor, you depress wages. And that was one problem. They didn't make as much politically. I don't know, though. It's a really good question because you make up the majority.
I've experienced that, the sexism part. Because I was, my first career, State Farm Insurance appointed me one of the first women in the country to be an insurance agent, because that had always been a men-only business. And so I was usually the only woman in the room or in the convention or in the conference or what have you, because it was just new. And they would always say things like, hey, guys, bring your wives. We're going to have Maria, you can come too. And we're going to, you know, blah, blah, because it was the old boys network. And then they even went on bonding trips to Northern California to go snow skiing and stuff. And I was not allowed to go because the wives would not have approved. And it was very uncomfortable. And I'm not one who looks to get singled out, because I am a we person. It's us. It's not, you know, me against the world kind of thing. But it was not comfortable. Let me just put it that way. That's an understatement. So I can only imagine what it is like for other women who break into fields. Talk radio was one of them. There's hardly still women in talk radio.
Right.
Political talk radio, there's like Laura Ingraham. That's it.
Right. I mean, there's just a handful of them. And and some of them I don't like. I'm not a big Rachel Maddow fan, and I'm not. I forget the Republican woman who's always on that just drives me crazy.
Ann Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Coulter. I'm not a big fan of Ms. Coulter's either. But you're right. There aren't a lot of women. And it's funny because my mom was on the radio, but my mom was.
Really?
She was a theatrical person though. So she did a children's radio show, kind of educational for PBS, did a children's radio show at NYS, which was kind of like a romper room show, if you remember that show from being a kid.
I do.
You know, but yeah, that she played the, you know, she did a traditional thing. And I don't know politically, because women make up the majority of the electorate, and my recollection from the last time I looked is they vote more than men do.
Yes, and they also are involved in the campaigns on the grassroots level, usually inordinately so, with walking precincts, getting out the vote, phone calls, poll watching. That's generally females that do that.
Right.
Candidates always thank us, because I belong to a federated group of Republican women, and they always say, if it weren't for you, I couldn't have gotten elected. You guys were the boots on the ground.
I had 110 people out on Election Day, and I'm sure the majority of them were women.
That was in 2012?
In 2014. Yeah. I've run for city council. I've run for, you know, I ran for city council in 2014 with no money and no endorsements. And I was one of 15 candidates, and the two top candidates win this office because it was city council at large and you vote for two. And I came in third out of 15.
Oh.
I just missed it. And I really had no money. We put all our money into Election Day, but we had a lot of women that worked hard and pushed me, so I'm grateful.
So, case in point, now, we had a conversation prior to us being on the air this afternoon evening about women wanting a woman in the White House. Do you want to speak to that? Okay. since here we have one, you know, a viable, well, both parties have, I think, I don't know what your thoughts are about Carly. I happen to like her myself, Fiorina, but Mrs. Clinton, case in point, with her speaking in front of, you know, the Benghazi panel and everything else, she's doing it, and she seems to really be making it happen.
Well, I think there are certain, you know, what I was saying to you earlier is I think there are women that really love Hillary Clinton, but I think there are other women who are liberal women who are saying we want her because she's a woman, because we know, and women know, you know, if there's a smarter sex, I would argue that it's women. I've raised women and I've raised men. In fact, I used to have a neighbor. I don't want to digress here, but I used to have a neighbor that had my favorite bumper sticker, and it said, "Grow your own dope, raise a man." But you know, I've raised both, and women get it right off the bat, right? Little girls, you know, the best thing you can be in the world is a 12-year-old boy, because nobody really expects anything of you. When you're a 12-year-old girl, they expect certain things of you. You have to be well-mannered and this and that. And, you know, but all us men grew up with, you know, doing ridiculous things well into almost adulthood, and people saying, well, he's a boy, you know, well, yeah, he's a boy.
Yeah. Boys will be boys.
But I think that people know that the more women you get in, the more women get in. My sister would have been, if she had survived, she died of breast cancer at 44. But if she had lived today, she would have been 72 years old. But when she graduated from GW Law School, she was one of three women in her graduating class. Now, every year, they graduate more women than they graduate men from GW mm-hmm. Law School. And that was the thing, you know, as soon as women started getting into law school, more women started getting into law school. And I think they understand, you know, that women understand this. And there's a certain amount that say, you know, we're not crazy about Hillary, but it's time to have a woman in the White House, because the more women that we get in positions of power, the more women will ultimately end up there.
Well, and I guess Madeleine Albright was one of the first, like, bigger forerunners in that regard. But you don't – yes, the foot's in the door, the crack has been opened, but it's not certainly a preponderance like it is, you know, as you're speaking about on the graduate level and on the bachelor's level. But, right. You know, it's more than 50-50 with women, but it's certainly not in elected offices and in the boardroom, frankly. But I don't want to sound like – like the "oh, poor me" kind of mentality. I hope I'm not coming across that way in that regard. I just find it odd that other countries have had women, Angela Merkel, for example, say, you know, that they're effective, they're leaders, they can get elected, they're strong, and they're respected.
Oh, absolutely. And we see all sorts of I once wrote a paper when I was in graduate school, for example, that we should have more women on police departments as patrol officers. And of course now we do. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember when I never saw a woman cop when I was in college, you know, mm-hmm. I saw meter maids, but they're, you know, right. And people like that, but I didn't see a real, you know, sworn officer, until I got close to adulthood. I argued that it made more sense to have women involved because they were less prone to be violent. They were more, they're more verbal. They're more, you know, and wouldn't you want people like that in confrontational positions? People that are more likely to negotiate than they are to use violence. And if right. you had women and men teams, wouldn't that work better, you know? And now we see a lot of women in law enforcement, and I think it has been a positive thing. But I don't know. I think that our society hasn't adjusted enough, and you know, now we're dealing with things like family leave and mm-hmm. other things that will make it I guess, easier for women because they do bear the primary responsibility for children. Right. I know when my kids have a problem, they want to go to their mom. They really do. And it's just an instinctual thing. If they have even if it's something that I can deal with just as well as they as their mom can deal with it, the first stop is always mom. So I think that's part of the problem. And another part of the problem is we don't make men. How many single moms are in this country that don't get support from the dads?
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
And those laws really haven't caught up. I mean, man, if you're not paying your child support, as far as I'm concerned, you ought to be in jail.
I've been on that end also, and it's really amazing how easy it is to get away with not being the contributing responsible person, even though it's mandated in the papers, you know.
Right.
There's the reality of it, and then there, I guess, there's the idealistic part. But, yeah, I've been down that road, too. It's not pretty either, but I was at least able to take care of the situation myself without the contributions. But
And we see that in you know, with the people that I deal with. But yeah, for a lot of people, that's not true. For a lot of women, that's not true. They really can't deal with it. It's funny that we should be on this particular subject, Maria, because I spent time this morning reading about the mother from Baltimore. I don't know if you remember this, but it was front page on the Washington Post. The mother from Baltimore who slapped her kid. Do you remember this?
Yes.
In the riot?
Yes,
she came out.
Yep.
And people called her a hero, right? Here
right.
She was. She grabbed that, you know, that little punk by the back of the neck and said, you're not getting into trouble. I'm your mother, and you know, you're not going to throw rocks at
policemen. I actually
saw
the footage.
She became a big hero, and it's funny because his sister, he was with a bunch of people throwing rocks at police officers, and his sister had just applied to be a member of the Baltimore police, and she said that to him. She said, "What are you, crazy? You want people throwing rocks at me? These are people, you know." But anyway, I digress. The woman is a single mom with five kids, barely making ends meet. She's 42 years old. She's a grandmother. And, you know, and her story was very sad because there were a lot of people that were trying to make her a national hero, and it looked like she was going to get out of poverty. But now the news cycle has moved on to somebody else. And so she's still where she was, you know. And, we got to do stuff to empower women. And look, while we sit here discussing this stuff, it looks like we're running out of time. So we're just about done. Maria Sanchez, welcome to our show. I look forward to a long association and making the world a better place for all of us. And I want to give you the last word before we sign off.
That we will get more substantive as we move forward, but we deliberately kept this program a little bit light and easy so that you could get a kind of glimpse into what our dynamics will be and a little bit about who I am. But
and
we're going to get it hard.
and Marie's been gentle with me because I'm an old man, and I appreciate that.
Stop.
So, goodbye, America. We'll see you next
week.
Yes. Hopefully we'll have a guest. I'm sorry. Here I say I'm giving you the last word, and then I take the last word. Go ahead, Maria. We got a minute left.
I hope everyone has a magnificent week, and we do want to make this world a better place, one person at a time, 1 hour at a time. It's possible.
Thanks, America. We'll see you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.